You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wantoku ingoa, ki te whakarongo koe ki te Wire maronga irirangi poho mō tēnei rā, te roa te kumatahi o kohi tātea. Kia ora. You're tuning into the Thursday Wire on 95 BFM for today, the 21st of January. It's a new day in the world. My name is Justin, and joining me, as usual, nothing's changed much in the studio, is Ayana Pivahelian.
Definitely send in my normal seat. Thank you, Justin. Kia ora.
Yes, and a lot has happened for the past, since this morning. We have a new president.
Oh, yes. I suppose that is a lot has happened.
Well, yeah. I mean, we have to memorize a new name for the same position that we've been talking about for the past 4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's just quite a toll that it's going to have on us, isn't it? How are we going to keep up? So much has changed.
We'll probably have to correct ourselves quite more often than we think. We have to say US President Donald Trump falls. Apologies, Joe Biden.
Hopefully not too much, hopefully.
Not too much, hopefully. So, FIKNA coming up on the show today. We have our regular chat with Health Minister and Labour MP Andrew Little and an international desk reports on this morning's inauguration of US President Joe Biden. What have you got, Ayana?
Yes, so I chatted to the Chief Operations Officer at Surf Life Saving New Zealand, Adam Wooler, and also I had a chat to the President of ALRAN's Abortion Rights Aotearoa about the lack of abortion services in South Auckland. That was Terry Bellamark.
And as usual, you can catch all these stories in full by podcast on the 95BFM website after the show. Or if you want to go back to the other shows that we did in the past few weeks. But if you want some instant reaction or interaction with both Ayana and myself, tuku patu hi mai, you can call us on 5395 or why my rane, call us on 309-3879.
Yeah, we'll pick up.
I tēnei wā tonu. Let's get to the Health Minister.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about drug testing at festivals, given that the government rushed through an emergency legislation to legalise them for over the summer, and security at Parliament following the attack at the US Capitol earlier this month and an axe attack on the Beehive several days later. But I kick things off by asking the Minister about the government's response to the new COVID variants and any updates to the new vaccine rollout. Starting with the government announcing pre-departure testing for all travellers entering the country. So, Labour, during the election, said pre-departure testing is fraudulent when National proposed, but now it is in place. What caused this U-turn?
Well, I think that the information available at the time was that pre-departure testing was of limited use, that if you were asymptomatic and you boarded a flight, you could acquire coronavirus during the course of the flight or maybe become symptomatic during the course of a flight and maybe become contagious at that point. I think with the arrival of the new variants, the much more contagious variants, I think it's now just about taking that extra precaution to make sure that anybody boarding a flight, at least at the time of that board, have demonstrated that they are non-symptomatic and that and they don't have the virus. It's an added safeguard. It's a small additional safeguard. It still means that all other safeguards have to be put in place. But even though it might provide limited additional protection, it is still worth doing that at the time of the much more contagious strain of the virus around.
Looking back at last year, in some cases, some our later community transmissions after level 4 was coming from managed isolation. So do our health system have the capacity to handle an outbreak of the new variant in the community?
Well, that's why, you know, we're beefing up being incredibly stringent about what happens in the managed isolation facilities and at the border. So they make sure that, you know, all the personnel who are working at the border and in the managed isolation facilities are all well protected, that, you know, the distancing rules are being followed, that the hygiene needs are being met. That's the only way we're gonna contain it. I mean, the new variant is, although it is much more contagious, it is not showing that when people get it, the period of time by which people get it is sped up or slowed down. So we've still got those same constraints. So we're doing the testing and what have you. We are now doing sort of day zero or day one testing, so testing straight away to make sure that those who travel long distances are tested straight away. We'll still leave in place the day three and the day 12 testing and then the 14-day period to isolate. That teach you what's going to protect us, and we just have to be absolutely strict about that.
Right, that's in managed isolation, but what happens, what will the government do? What is the action plan if the variant is discovered in the community?
If there is a case of community transmission, whether it's this variant or any, or the original kind of strain of the virus, I mean, we have an action plan ready to kick in. So there's an immediate response, and it depends, you know, how quickly traceable origins of the community transmission are. But the same action plan that was around when we had the outbreak in August is there for now. That is really the step in, you know, the minute there is any evidence of community transmission.
But moving on away from the border, and I want to now talk about vaccines. Now, the vaccine rollout, according to COVID-19 Response Minister Chris Hipkins, said it won't start as far as March or even later in the middle of the year. Now, other countries have already started their vaccine rollouts. Why can't we do the same?
Look, most of the other countries that are rolling out right now are countries that have been in a pre-pilot situation. So they've been in a state really of emergency. You know, you look at the UK and the US in particular, even Israel, which is, you know, reasonably well advanced in their vaccination program. They were having cases of community transmission and death on a daily basis and at an elevated level. That's not the situation that we're in. And they rolled out their vaccination program on the basis of very, very limited approval because the data, not all the data is in about the side effects of the vaccine or the various vaccines that are around. We've got the luxury of taking a bit of time to make sure that we know whatever vaccines are available in New Zealand are safe to use, and we know what the risks and the side effects and so on are. We have, because of the new strain, there is a possibility that we may be able to bring forward the arrival of some of the vaccine into New Zealand, particularly because we want to get our border staff and border personnel vaccinated as quickly as possible. But, you know, we're part of the arrangements with the various pharmaceutical companies, as well as through the international arrangements that were signed up through COVAX, and we're dependent on those arrangements about the arrival of vaccines into New Zealand. But there's a possibility that we may be able to get some early tranches of the vaccine, and so we can start for the particularly sensitive groups, which in this case for us at the moment is the border personnel.
Can we say the government's strategy for this is to hold the border as long as possible until the vaccine is rolled out?
Yeah, well, that goes without saying. I mean, until there's some level of control worldwide, then the border restrictions are going to be in place. But, you know, as soon as we can get, you know, vaccinations rolled out, and not just in New Zealand, but worldwide. And bearing in mind, too, in terms of relevant coverage, it is going to take months for ourselves and the world to get, you know, the level of vaccination coverage that we need to get. And there will be a sequence by which we do it. As I said, the, you know, border personnel will be pretty much first up. There'll be at-risk communities, which include the elderly, vulnerable populations like Māori and Pacifica. And there'll be an order in which these things happen. But we, you know, we're in a position where, because of the current circumstances, we don't have community transmission, and we're not suffering deaths on a daily basis, we can afford to wait until we are sure about the data and the risks associated with it and make sure it's safe to administer to New Zealand citizens.
You mentioned about ethnic communities. Overseas, let's say in Britain, there is some concern among these communities about the vaccine, or some part of these communities are sceptical of it. Mm. Let's say if that happened in New Zealand, what is the government going to do to reduce this kind of scepticism among these communities towards the vaccine?
Yeah, so there will be some scepticism. It's natural. And so we're putting together a communications program at the moment to give people good information about the vaccination, about the vaccines that are available, and why we do a vaccination program. It is about protecting people. And I think a part of the message will be to think not just of yourself, but actually of others, not just those in your household, but those across the rest of the community. That's what you have a vaccination program for. So look, we'll work very carefully with that. And make sure that, as I say, there's good information and good trusted voices providing that information. But there will never be a time when there isn't going to be some level of scepticism about vaccinations. It just is the kind of the culture that we're in at the moment. What we've got to do is make sure that we get the best information out about the safety of these vaccines.
Moving on away from testing and vaccines towards drug testing. Now, our news director Jemima Houston went to a couple of music festivals during the break, and she found that drug testing services is unavailable in major festivals. And given that a large number of dangerous substances are found for festivals that do have drug testing, when you rolled the approval for drug testing last year, do you expect they will be fully prepared for a sudden increase in demand?
Well, we did the law change we did because we took the view that those who've been doing the drug testing up to now have been taking a huge risk, a huge legal risk in doing so. And in fact, they've been struggling to get volunteers to help out in doing that work. So we wanted to provide some protection for those straight away. And that's why what we did was very much an interim measure. And it was really just to provide the legal protection straight away. It wasn't about saying, right, we're not only going to do that, we're going to try and beef up the resources for it. I think, we can predict once that protection was in place, yes, there would be an increase in demand. Other festival organisers and hosts would want those services there. And the organisations that do the drug testing, like Know Your Stuff, have simply been overwhelmed too. We're now in the process of making sort of the more permanent law change, which we'll do throughout this year. We'll have a look at the issue about resourcing and so on and work with those organisations. I can't make any particular promises about that, but we know the demand is there. And of course, it's not just the music festivals. What I'm very clear about is that when we put in place a permanent regime, it's not just for music festivals that in the end appeal to a particular demographic. Actually, there are dangerous drugs on our streets every day, all the time, and we have to have the ability for people to go and get those substances tested to check that they're safe. In the end, this is about safety, and we'll take this year to work with the various stakeholders to make sure that what we put in place is the best we can do with what we've got.
Right. Moving on to my final topic for today. Now, when we were off air, there has been an attack on the United States Capitol. Just days after that, a man was arrested for smashing a window down at our own parliament with an axe. Given of these events that happened, are you concerned about the security at Parliament?
No, it seems that the incident at the Beehive was isolated. The person appears to be somebody who is pretty unwell. He was bailed to a forensic mental health facility. That suggests that there are other issues than just criminal intent behind that. Now, compared to the what happened at the Capitol at Washington DC, that was an organised attempt at trying to stop a democratic process. The people who were there, thousands who were there, knew what they were doing and were there for malign, bad purposes. I don't think you can necessarily say that of the one person who talked to the Beehive with an axe a couple of weeks ago.
Surely there are supporters of those organisations in New Zealand. Has the intelligence agencies been monitoring their movements?
There will be supporters of those organisations in New Zealand. There are people who kind of articulate that. I arrived in Nelson yesterday. Labour caucus was meeting today, and there was a chap walking up the street, shouting on the top of his voice how good Donald Trump was and how important it was, and he had to be protected and what have you. So there are people who have that view. Look, I can't say what our intelligence agencies are doing or not doing, but there will be people in New Zealand, as there are in any other country, with all sorts of weird and wonderful views. Whether that leads to threats to the security of our democratic institutions or leads to kind of the turmoil that we've seen in the US, I don't think we're anywhere near that because we have a different political climate and context at the moment.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Kei te whakamokoe ki te waia maronga I rirangi pōho. That was Health Minister Andrew Little. The time is just up to 20 past 12. You're listening to 95BFM. This is the Thursday Wire with me, Justin, and we will be going after a break. We'll be back after a while.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words, because he waka eke noa. Karawhiua. Give it heaps. Go hard.
Your mark's really grown compared with my Sam, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Yes, Sam! Cut a few up! Kick it, boy! Ah.
Oh.
Yeah, you'll kick it next time.
Cut a few. Give it heaps. Go hard. Māori words. Cut a few. Give it a go.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
No idea.
Okay, what about tree trunks and six?
What does that even mean?
Shit, you're useless. Oh. Don't you know anything?
Oh, well, I know tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's Michael Matiniak Trio live with support from Al Nose and Andy JV.
Go on.
And tomorrow, Corey Gonzalez McCure and friends with support from Bobby Bazooka and Junior.
Sweet as! One of those actually solved 13 across. Cheers. Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
No candlelit dinners, no commercial mush. Celebrate Anti-Valentine's Day at Motat with fun, dancing, karaoke, live music, The Love Police, and all sorts of antics. Motat Anti-Valentine's, Saturday, February 13, 7 to 11 p.m. Tickets just $20 or $15 for students from motat.nz. R18.
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11 p.m. Only on 95BFM.
Hei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and now, Iana.
Yes, so before I chatted to Adam Willer, the Chief Operations Officer at Surf Life Saving New Zealand, and Justin, I've got a question for you.
Yes, go on.
Do you know how to identify a rip?
What's a rip?
A rip current. Well, according to a new study by Surf Life Saving New Zealand and a big collaboration of universities around New Zealand and Australia, you're not alone. 78% of beachgoers in New Zealand don't know how to identify a rip. And there are around 5 drownings each year due to rip currents and around 700 rescues. So, yes, I chatted to Adam Willer about rips, what to do, and about the research. And I started off by asking him how to identify a rip.
Well, it's actually very, very difficult. And I think this research proves the point. We've been trying to teach people how to spot a rip for years, both in here in New Zealand and right across the globe. And the research is showing us that we're not actually being successful. A rip is something that it's not too hard to spot from above, but you can take aerial photographs and share drone footage to show what a rip looks like. And most pictures of rips are like that. You can look on our website and see them. But people don't see rip currents from the air. They see them from eye level by in front of the surf before they go in. And it's really difficult to spot. I could tell you now, but I think most people wouldn't remember. So we're going to concentrate on telling people what to do if they get caught in a rip, and look at research to see if we can teach people differently.
So what do you do if you're caught in a rip?
Well, for us, it's simple. And I think this is a proven technique which is being tested around the world. And it's to remember the three R's. The first one is to relax and float. Conserve your energy. If you fight against the rip, that's when you'll get into trouble and get tired and you'll drown. The second R is to raise your hand and signal for help. Because invariably a lifeguard or member of the public will see you and call for help. And the last one is to ride the rip. The last R is ride the rip until it stops and you can swim in. Or 50% of rips actually circulate, and it could actually bring you back to shore. So relax, raise your hand, and ride the rip. And those three things could save your life.
And how do you know if you are caught in a rip? Because like you say, you can't always see a rip unless you're, you know, from above or maybe on the beach. But it's even harder to know when you are in the water, isn't it?
It can be. People can be playing and suddenly turn around and feel that they see that they've been moved, or feel the current on their legs or from their waist down. We tell people always that they should be looking for a reference point on the land. So if you feel yourself being moved sideways or then out, you're in a rip. Best thing to do is just make your way to the shore if you can. But if you can't, again, remember those three R's.
And can you give us a little bit of background about how rips are formed?
Yeah, sure. Rips really are just an outward moving body of water that goes out through channels. So the waves come in, and the water has to go out somewhere. And the water rushes out through channels. When the tide goes out and you're walking along the beach, you can actually see these channels. And so when the tide comes in, then that's where the rips are going to be. You spot a rip by looking for sort of dark patches of water, and it's where the waves aren't breaking is where often a rip occurs. And that's what lulls people into the false sense of security. They think, I'll go there because there aren't any waves. Well, actually, there aren't any waves because there's a current feeding out, and it stops the waves breaking. So the safest thing to do is swim where there are waves. Even safer still, and one of our mantras, choose a lifeguarded beach, swim between the flags, because the lifeguards will put flags up where there aren't rips.
And 78% of beachgoers not knowing how to identify a rip, that seems like a really, really big number. Did the research bring up anything else that you think that we should know about?
Well, interestingly, people who were able to identify a rip in a photograph, two-thirds of them then couldn't identify the rip on the beach itself. So what that tells us is that people think they understand rips, but it's really hard to put that knowledge into practice. So it's one thing learning about rips at school or reading on the internet or seeing beach safety signs, but it's a very big step between doing that and being able to spot one in real life. So we're going to have to go back to the drawing board, as are our colleagues in Australia, because this research has been replicated over there, and look at novel ways of teaching perhaps kids using gaming technology, virtual reality, ways to immerse them in a real beach environment and then try and teach them about rips. But that may not even work because rips are complicated. We've learned that over the years of study with drifters and other sort of coastal geomorphology research, and they are a complex thing, so hard to understand, even harder to teach someone to spot.
So that was Adam Wooler, Chief Operations Officer at Surf Life Saving New Zealand.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
So the second story that I have looked into today is the fact that there are no abortion clinics in South Auckland. The closest to South Auckland is Green Lane, which creates a few barriers for those trying to access those sort of health services. Abortion was decriminalised in March last year, and the issue of no abortion clinics in South Auckland has been raised repeatedly over the past 12 years, and it's an issue, and yet there are still none there. So to discuss the impact of this and what changes could be on the horizon now it's been decriminalised, I spoke with the president of ALRAN's Abortion Rights Aotearoa, Terry Balamack. I started off by asking Terry what the social effects are of not having accessible abortion services.
It's a real burden on people who need the services who live so far away from the services, because the folks in South Auckland, if they need abortion care, they need to go up to Epsom Day Unit, which is a long drive. And if you don't have your own transportation, it can be a long, expensive proposition. Plus, you know, when you're going to appointments like that, you have to find childcare, you have to take time off work, and the fact that it's so far away means that you need to take more time than you would if these services were available, say, at Middlemore Hospital.
And abortion was decriminalised last March, and is there any indication that there is going to be changes for abortion services availability in South Auckland?
Yeah, actually, I was reading that they put out to tender requests for people who are interested in supplying that service in South Auckland and in Waitemata. I don't know what the status of that is, and I really wish them well on that because, I mean, something that needed to happen like 14 years ago.
So abortion was decriminalised last March. Are there any expectations from ALRANS for action after this legislation was passed?
We have lots of expectations, but we also have to be realistic about the fact that, you know, because it was coming out of the Crimes Act, they weren't able to implement any kind of a bedding in period, any sort of a transition time. So basically, the transition time is kind of now. They're working on it. We're hoping to see a lot of movement in that space, you know, over this year. It's a bit, it's a bit disappointing that it's taking so long, but, you know, it was always going to take the time that it took. We're hoping to see, the kind of changes that we're hoping to see from the Ministry of Health involve, you know, things like mandating that all DHBs must offer an abortion service. Because, you know, South Auckland is bad, but the West Coast, if you need abortion care on the West Coast, you still have to go to Canterbury. You have to go to Christchurch. That's an even bigger burden. And, you know, and it's not, you know, to say that any one burden is bigger or better or worse than the others. I mean, it's all unacceptable.
Any other action that you are hoping to see from the health sector in the coming year?
We're hoping to see, safe areas would be really good. Safe areas is the next bit of legislation that's going to be coming up, and we're hoping to see that pass because it's really important. And I think what we're seeing, the kind of activity that we saw in the States just recently, you know, shows how bad it can really get. The problem with safe areas is, you know, it's the one thing that I hear most often from people who tell me about their abortions. What they talk about most was, you know, I was so scared, you know, if the protesters were going to be out there, or yeah, I saw the protesters, it made me so mad, or yeah, it was really, you know, intimidating to walk by these people who were staring at me. It's really not acceptable that people who are just trying to go about their day, who are just trying to access healthcare, legal healthcare now, as I might add, are being faced with this kind of really standover tactics.
And what is your advice to anyone in South Auckland or anywhere in Aotearoa, New Zealand, that is trying to overcome the barriers to access abortion?
Call your DHB, and if you don't get a satisfactory, or call your DHB, call family planning. If you don't get a satisfactory answer from those folks, call ALRANS, or rather send an email to ALRANS. And I generally try and, you know, help hook people up with services that are out there. And, you know, hopefully this gets easier.
That was Terry Balamack, the president of Al Rand's Abortion Rights Aotearoa. Yet when she brought up safe spaces, it had totally slipped my mind that that had been removed from the bill. So last year we did decriminalise abortion, but then ACT leader David Seymour proposed removing the definition of safe spaces from the bill, and also being at the ability to be able to implement safe spaces when they're needed the most. And his proposal for that actually passed. So as the current bill stands, police cannot implement safe zones to protect women from harassment while they try and get an abortion, even though the abortion is decriminalised. So as always, we would love to hear from you. Tuku pātui mai. Text us your thoughts, opinions, 5395, or YMI. Call us for a yarn. I'll pick up 309 3879.
Thanks, Sianna. Moving on to overseas.
Where in the world is Justin Wong? It's Overseas Experience, your international news update on 95BFM.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
Office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability,
will to the best of my ability
preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
That was US President Joe Biden swearing in this morning at his inauguration in Washington, D.C. In his inauguration speech, the president said it was a victory for democracy and called for unity. He also already signed in 15 executive orders to implement a mask mandate at federal property, restoring the federal office to handle pandemics that his predecessor Donald Trump had abolished, pausing student loan repayments, and rejoining the Paris Climate Accords.
This is America's day. This is democracy's day, a day of history and hope, of renewal and resolve. Through a crucible for the ages, America has been tested anew, and America has risen to the challenge. Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause, the cause of democracy. The people, the will of the people, has been heard. And the will of the people has been heeded. We've learned again that democracy is precious. Democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed.
President Biden replaces Donald Trump, whose unorthodox behavior and policies during his 4 years in office shook up American and world politics. It all began in 2015 when the then businessman and reality TV star announced his candidacy for the White House and pledged a border wall alongside America's border with Mexico, as well as repealing his predecessor Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act.
Just to sum up, I would do various things very quickly. I would repeal and replace the big lie Obamacare. I would build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me, believe me. And I'll build them very inexpensively. I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Yeah. Mark my words. Yeah. Nobody would be tougher on ISIS than Donald Trump. Woo. Nobody. I will find within our military, I will find the General Patton, or I will find General MacArthur. I will find the right guy. I will find the guy that's going to take that military and make it really work. Nobody, nobody will be pushing us around.
Trump's administration then centered on a vision of America First, which emphasized isolationism and rejected international cooperation. That saw the US pulling out of numerous international organizations and agreements, including the Paris Climate Accords, the Iranian nuclear deal, the UN Human Rights Council, as well as imposing a travel ban on numerous Muslim countries. But on the But the Trump administration for the past 4 years also have some positive foreign policy accomplishments, including holding a successful summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore and eradicating the terrorist organization Islamic State.
We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first. Every decision on trade, on taxes, on immigration, on foreign affairs will be made to benefit American workers and American families. We must protect our borders from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies, and destroying our jobs.
But back home, Trump was facing numerous troubles after defeats, controversial comments, and scandals. Just months into his presidency, Senate Republicans, including the now deceased Senator John McCain, vetoed his plans to fully repeal Obamacare. And after white supremacist rallies in Charlottesville, Virginia, resulted in 3 deaths, the president's refusal to condemn white supremacists and saying there were, quote, fine people on both sides, attracted much criticism.
And what I'm saying is this: you had a group on one side and you had a group on the other, and they came at each other with clubs, and it was vicious and it was horrible, and it was a horrible thing to watch. But there is another side. There was a group on this side, you can call them the left, you've just called them the left, that came violently attacking the other group. So you can say what you want, but that's the way it is.
The president also faced scandals over his past 4 years that alleged him for intervening in domestic politics with foreign actors. He was accused of having ties with Russia that allowed Moscow to interfere with the 2016 election, but an investigation by special counsel Robert Mueller did not find any wrongdoing. But Trump's luck ran out at the second time, when a transcript of a phone call between him and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was leaked to the Congressional Judiciary Committee, showing political rival Joe, showing that the president withheld aid funds to Kiev in exchange for them to investigate his then political rival Joe Biden's son Hunter, who had questionable business dealings in the country. The House of Representatives, led by Speaker Nancy Pelosi, impeached the president, but he managed to stay in office after being acquitted by the Republican-held Senate. But just like how he entered the center of Washington by kicking down doors in 2016, the final year of Trump's presidency ended with a bang. As COVID-19 ravaged across the U.S., the president discouraged lockdowns and mass testing while promoting alternative treatments for COVID-19.
When you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people. You're going to find more cases. So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please. They test and they test. We got tests that people don't know what's going on. We got tests. We got another one over here. The young man's 10 years old. He's got the sniffles. He'll recover in about 15 minutes. That's a case. Add up to it. That's a case.
Supposing we hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light. And I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it. And then I said, supposing you brought the light inside the body, which you can do either through the skin or in some other way. And I think you said you're going to test that too. Sounds interesting.
We'll get the right folks equipped.
Right. And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
after his failed re-election bids for president against the now president Joe Biden, Trump continuously refused to concede the election and made false claims for election fraud, including attempting to force Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to manipulate the state's numbers to show he won. Less than 1 month before the transition of power and right before Congress's certification of the electoral votes, the president's appearance before the Save America rally led to a violent mob of his supporters to storm the Capitol in an attempt to overturn his defeat. It led to Donald Trump becoming the first president in the history of the United States to be impeached twice, and whether he will be eligible for other public roles in the future now rests in the hands of a Senate trial.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election. We did win this election. So our goal now is to ensure the integrity for the good of this nation. This is a very big moment. This is a major fraud in our nation. We want the law to be used in a proper manner. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list, okay? It's a very sad moment. To me, this is a very sad moment, and we will win this, and we, as far as I'm concerned, we already have won.
Let's have trial by combat.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved. Our country has had enough. We will not take it anymore. And that's what this is all about. And to use a favorite term that all of you people really came up with, we will stop the steal. We have come to demand that Congress do the right thing and only count the electors who have been lawfully slated. I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. Today we will see whether Republicans stand strong for integrity of our elections, but whether or not they stand strong for our country. Our country. Our country has been under siege for a long time.
And with that, after a bit of kerfuffle, one border war, one pandemic, two impeachments, and thousands of tweets, the Donald Trump presidency is finally over. Now Joe Biden is in charge.
Overseas experience with Justin Wong, only on 95 BFM.
You have something to say on the president? No. Nothing. But before we move on, I have this final clip of the president during his 2016 campaign, and I think you should listen to it.
We're going to win so much, you may even get tired of winning, and you'll say, please, please, it's too much winning. We can't take it anymore. Mr. President, it's too much. And I'll say, no, it isn't. We have to keep winning. We have to win more. We're going to win more. We're going to win so much.
Very 2021 energy. Now, but before we're following that, we are going to have a quick break. You're listening to The Thursday Wire on 95 BFM.
Straight
Proper are taking over Nick of the Woods for back-to-back six-hour sets from two of New Zealand's finest DJs. Up-and-coming Wellingtonian Benny Salvador and Auckland legend Dylan C let loose on the celebrated handcrafted Ghost sound system. Proper presents Benny Salvador this Friday and Dylan C this Saturday at Nick of the Woods. Tickets are moving fast. Get yours now from ticketfairy.co.nz.
Nothing says summer like the smell of sunscreen, a picnic on the beach, crisp salad, succulent dip, and the best organic sourdough either side of the Bombays. Bread and Butter make real sourdough, supporting organic practices with New Zealand-grown grains and the best locally supplied ingredients. Bread and Butter, for bread that's better. Three stores across Auckland, Grayland, Milford and Ponsonby. And coming soon to the Coast Plaza in Whangaparoa. Order online at breadandbutter.nz.
Wow, music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
Oh, Happy New Year. Our Best of 2020 playlist is live right now, featuring Vanessa Worm, Cave Circles, Lorraine James, and Samara Alofa.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for a monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hotaka katoa mo tēnei rā, and that's all for the Thursday Wire today. Nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero me kia mō tēnei rā. Thank you to those who talked to us today, and as well as my producer Iana Piperhelion and news director Jemima Houston. Kia hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. Thank you for tuning in, and I'll see you next week. I'm handing you over to Sigrid for the 124 now. But before that, I'm leaving you with Lil Wayne because it's suiting the topic or the theme for this week about the transition, given that the rapper himself was pardoned by President Donald Trump for carrying a gun and bullets when police searched his plane in Miami. And he could face a 10-year prison sentence, but he now got out. And beside that, he's a massive Trump supporter. Yeah, sometimes two and two does add up. See you next week. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.